Person of the Week is brought to you by Citi. With global expertise and over two centuries of experience, Citi provides tools, insights, and guidance to help businesses thrive. They're not just any bank. They are Citi. Learn more at citi.com/wearecity.
I just remember the first sketch I was in. It was an MTV piece, and I had a microphone, thank God, so I had something to grab. I was an MTV VJ, and I remember just reading the cards. The scariest thing is making sure you don't flub the lines reading the cue cards. It's kind of like that feeling of, oh God, what if I get to school and I'm like not wearing pants? Or what if you have to go accept an award and you trip? You don't know until you get out there what it feels like. And then it's like anything. You get used to that room tone and you get used to that sound. Plus you get used to that anticipation of laughter following your words.
Maya Rudolph is a comedy legend. The beloved comedian is known for some of the most memorable impressions on Saturday Night Live, from Donatella Versace to Beyonce to Kamala Harris, and for her unforgettable performance in the blockbuster comedy Bridesmaids alongside SNL castmate Kristen Wiig. She's been nominated for nearly a dozen Emmys for her work on shows like Big Mouth and The Good Place. She's won 5 and now stars as a billionaire divorcee on her new show, Loot. The second season of Loot is out now on Apple TV, and Rudolph is one of our 2024 Time 100 honorees. In this conversation, we talked about the similarities between musicians and comedians, what it was like to be part of a cohort of so many incredible women on SNL, and her band, Princess. I'm Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent for Time, and this is Person of the Week. Okay, so your hit comedy series, Loot, on Apple TV, which premiered in June of 2022 and is now in its second season. You are an executive producer on the show, but you also play the billionaire divorcee, Molly Novak. Can you tell us a little bit about what excited you about this role and this world and this setup?
The world is so fun because I think there's that element of anything can happen in the world of billionaires. It's that fun idea of like, wow, if I had all the money in the world, what would I do with it? It feels like pretend. It's a pretend amount of money, you know?
Right.
So I like that aspect of it. I felt like the minute Matt Hubbard and Alan Yang, the show's creators, came to me with the idea, you could just picture it going everywhere. And then I think with great power comes great responsibility, right? So there's the element of, if you had all this money, what would you do with it? Would you use it for good after you spent lots and lots of money on, you name it, pedicures, sushi, you know, tropical islands?
Right.
But I mean, I think the part about Molly that keeps her grounded is her interest in humanity, in people. And she doesn't see herself as better than other people. I think she really, truly enjoys all of her money and the life that she's been living, but it is very egoless when it comes to the idea of how rarefied her air has been for so long. She doesn't hold it above people, which I think just allows her to go everywhere, get to know everyone, do everything. And I think through those relationships that she forges, you're able to really get to know Molly. I like her being the hero of the story because she's your guide. She takes you everywhere. And I'm never that interested in characters that don't really have empathy or are inconsiderate of others unless it's like fully arch, which I think is also really fun.
Right.
But that's not what this show is. You know, I think Disenchanted was the last time I got to play just like a fully evil, hideous creature. And like, that's so fun, but it's the element of ridiculous that makes it palatable because you know, no one would ever really behave that way. So I think as our guide, Molly really has to have that dose of empathy and genuine interest in others.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about what you would do if you had this amount of money that Molly has?
Yeah, I have, because people ask me about it a lot and I realize, oh, I feel so absolutely different than Molly Wells. I mean, listen, I, like most people, I think, would spend it on something absolutely ridiculous at first and think, oh, good, I bet there'll be some left over to do something really good with it.
So what would be the ridiculous thing you'd spend it on?
Well, I would really love some sort of ridiculous, like, exotic location house, right? Like, and maybe some sort of transportation that makes it really easy to get there, whether it's by air or by boat.
Right.
But then, you know, I feel like when you're getting down to the nitty-gritty, there's no way I could live with myself if I wasn't going to help someone with it.
Right.
I'd also, by the way, I would want a personal chef, because being around David Chang these last couple of years of working with him, it is so incredible to watch someone like that make food and taste his food. It is otherworldly and transcendent, and it takes you to such a happy place eating incredible food that you do not have to cook yourself. It always tastes better. So maybe I would, you know, just call a couple chefs and have them come over.
So David Chang is on the show, Molly's personal chef, but are you saying that he actually makes the food that you guys eat on set?
Well, sometimes we get to eat his food, yes. So there was a dish.
Oh my God.
In the first season, I believe it was like, it had like a shaved, like freeze-dried foie gras over this like puffy, floaty, light thing. I don't even remember anymore. And I had to eat it on camera every time.
Wow.
It was incredible. But then the tragedy of comedy is that we end up writing him making me microwave burritos all the time. So
have you always had this comedy gene, or how old were you when you realized that you really loved to make people laugh?
I think I was pretty little. I think it's always been there. I think it was very encouraged in terms of my parents wanting me to be me. And I was out there, honey. I was out there. But I think, you know, in the best possible way. And I do remember always being the friend that made my friends laugh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Throughout childhood, throughout high school, throughout college. It's definitely, you know, a creation of wanting to protect yourself as well, you know, having some sort of suited up armor. Mm-hmm. But I also have an older brother who I've always looked up to that was just the funniest person I knew growing up. And so when you're the little sibling, you want to be as cool as your older sibling. And my brother was really into all the cool, funny stuff when we were kids. And I think I got introduced to it at a younger age. It's like how you're seeing little kids be influenced by TikTok now and like wearing makeup.
Interesting.
It's like I was seeing Mel Brooks movies and The Gong Show at a very, very young age and thinking like, that's cool. I want to do that.
And so, you know, you come from a family of musicians. Your late mother was the singer Minnie Riperton, and your father is music producer Richard Rudolph. Were your parents funny? I mean, was this something that was kind of happening in your family? Or I guess I'm just generally curious about how your parents' career and performance translated into your comedy career.
Absolutely. I think from what I've been told, my mom was actually very funny. And my dad always says that if she hadn't been a singer, she would have been a comedian. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but I find that to be very sweet.
Yeah.
My parents were really young and really cool and hip. And, you know, they were babies when we were born, and they were musicians and all their friends were musicians. And I felt like that spirit was very alive, that kind of funny, natural banter. I also find comedians and musicians to be cousins. You know, they're kind of the same cloth. They're
in what way?
I think they're both people who have an innate gift. I think it's about timing, and I think it's a language. I think both comedy and music are both languages, and I can't count how often you hear comedians wanting to be musicians and musicians quoting famous comedians and, you know, all the times that they watched this funny thing on the tour bus or, you know, they're really similar in a lot of ways. And it's not something I know how to articulate. It's just a feeling. And I feel like when I talk to musicians about it, they completely get it. You know, they say, like, you're right. It's a thing. I also find it really interesting in the 70s when my parents were touring and stuff like that, it was really common for people to be on the same bill as comedians. I know I found this great home movie of my parents and the marquee said the Smothers Brothers and Minnie Riperton, you know, they would be on the road together. And my dad said, oh yeah, one of the Smothers Brothers taught your brother how to yo-yo, you know,
oh my
backstage
God.
Or something like that. But I think those things also kind of went hand in hand.
Right.
It was almost like treated like a rock show.
You mentioned that you would go on tour with your parents and you got to watch your mother perform. What do you remember about that experience of watching from backstage?
I was pretty little, so, you know, I think it was more about the environment, the joyful, exciting element that was backstage. Backstage is fun. It's like there's snacks. There's snacks and there's weird big rooms to run around in and play in and different people and people that want to play with you or say hello. It's a very social atmosphere. I definitely remember seeing my mom on stage, but it's funny that that's not the takeaway, but I know it's ingrained. There was some footage somebody put online recently that I saw of me in the audience. And one of my aunts is holding me, watching my mom, and I'm screaming. I'm so angry. And I think it's because, you know, kids want their moms to be their moms.
Right.
You know, I've experienced that when my children were little at SNL and you're wearing a wig, they don't like it. They want mommy to be mommy. And I don't blame them, you know.
Right.
I get it. So
right.
As much as I think that stuff was lost on me as a little kid, it got in there. It got into the potion somehow and made an impact on me. But I'm sure that my childlike takeaway was like, stop looking at my mom. That's my mom, you know?
Right.
Which I find very fascinating. But yeah, it's anytime I go to a recording studio or things like that now, I still have that really comforting sense of just how fun it is, because I think, you know, as kids, we would get to go to work with our parents and we would go to the studio and they had drinks and snacks and a pinball machine and things like that. Like, those are the takeaways of the child mind.
Yeah. This reminds me, both my parents are also journalists, and I used to, when I was a kid, go to work with them. And I just remember that it would be like people would have these offices where it was just books all over the floor. Like, you could not walk. You could not see the floor of the room because it was just books and papers and like political buttons and just stuff from political campaigns, like all over everything, the biggest mess you've ever seen in your life. So just this idea of like these kids kind of walking into this adult environment feels very familiar to me.
It's interesting, right? Because it is an adult environment, which I think is why sometimes we want to keep our children and not have them. You know, people always say to me like, oh, do you want your children to pursue? And so they're like, sure, when they're adults, but like it's an adult world. So I feel like children should be allowed to be children first in order to develop that good old frontal lobe and all those good things.
Right.
You know?
More with Maya Rudolph when we come back.
Person of the Week is brought to you by Citi. They're not an airline, but their network connects global businesses in nearly 160 local markets. They're not writers, but they help clients shape their financial story. With global expertise and over two centuries of experience, Citi provides tools, insights, and guidance to help businesses thrive. They're not just any bank. They are Citi. Learn more at citi.com/wearecity.
I understand you performed with the band The Rentals before joining the famous LA comedy troupe The Groundlings. So I just want to ask you a little bit about this pivot. You know, it sounded like you were sort of more thinking of a career in music and then you pivoted to comedy. So what was that moment like?
It was never a real thought. I was coming back from college and one of my oldest childhood friends, my friend Rachel Hayden, her band That Dog was going on tour and she was not able to tour. So she suggested me. And, you know, we grew up, she and Petra and their sister Tanya and I all used to harmonize at home when we were kids. And so she knew I was a serial harmonizer and that I played keyboards. And it was perfect. I was fresh out of college. I didn't have a job. And I just went on the road for 6 months. And what's funny is I heard when you said the word pivot, I thought, wow, I never even considered it a pivot. I just feel like it's all been the same space for me. They're both very large parts of me. I mean, when we were on the road, I remember goofing around with everybody and laughing and someone saying, "You're so funny, Maya. You know, you should be a comedian," or something like that. I mean, it was just sort of like normal at that point when I was, you know, 22, 23, something like that. But it never felt like a pivot. It was just one of the muscles that I was I was just using. And the same idea that, you know, when I'm in the middle of telling a story, I impersonate someone's voice, but like I'm not an impressionist.
Right.
But I never thought that I could do impressions. And then I realized, oh, I do them all the time. Or I sing like other people all the time, but I never thought about it as that.
So I want to ask you about your impressions because you're one of the great performers of impressions. For me, my personal favorite is your Maya Angelou doing pranks. You've done Beyonce, you've done Donatella Versace, you've done Kamala Harris. But for me, Maya Angelou is like at the top.
Wow.
I am curious, what makes somebody easy to imitate? Like, what are you looking for when you are trying to do one of these performances?
I really didn't think that I was going to be one of the impressionists when I started working at SNL. At the time, Daryl Hammond was the resident impressionist. And to me, that was like otherworldly, like James Beard level chef. Like I'm not even close to. And I didn't really touch it because I don't really think of my impressions as impressions. They're a bit more like characters. I'm kind of fudging them and putting my own sauce in there and kind of making them up. I mean, Donatella sounds like that, but we also just made her something that was like superhuman. Like she could get electrocuted in the bath and like think it's fun. So, you know, that element of it was sort of my background in sketch comedy and like making more of a character out of it in order to understand how a person spoke. So I don't know. I remember Oprah being written for me. And I remember saying, I do not know how to do this. I don't know how Oprah speaks. I mean, I can hear it, but I can't hear it. And I asked Daryl Hammond at the time what to do. And he gave me pointers. He said, notice the way her mouth is turned. Notice the way she goes up in speech. It really helped me get into it. And then I just picked up little isms along the way. But without that quick little masterclass from him, I don't know that I would have gotten it. And sometimes I don't get it. I mean, they had me come do Obama early on. And I'm talking about Barack, not Michelle.
Oh.
And I could not do it. I tried and I couldn't do it. And it wasn't until I heard Fred Armisen do it and figure out his cadence and his way of speaking that I thought, oh, that's what it is. And now I can do it if I'm talking to you and retelling a story. But I think my party trick with impressions is more just finding funny ways to say certain things. I don't ever really feel that they're true impressions. I think there are three types of performers at Saturday Night Live at all times. There's sketch performers, there's stand-ups, and there's impressionists. And sometimes the two shall meet, but you can tell people's tone from those worlds, and they're very different brains. I love it. I find it very fascinating.
So in 2005, you had your first daughter, Pearl, while you were still on the show. I can't imagine what that must have been like. I mean, how did you have a newborn while you were performing on SNL?
It was brutal. It was so ill-conceived and brutal. It was, you know, Anna Gasteyer had done it before. She had been pregnant on the show, and I thought, oh, that looks okay to do. That doesn't scare me as much as I thought it would. And I think in retrospect, I mean, you know, doing something you already know how to do is much easier than learning something new while you're pregnant or while you have a new baby. Right. So I just kind of went along, and I didn't really know how I would feel once I had her. So I took some maternity leave. It was only like 3.5 months. And I only came back that early because Steve Martin was hosting and Prince was the musical guest. Mm-hmm. And so I flew across country and came back. That is truly why I broke my maternity leave.
Because you just couldn't miss that.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. That was my childhood love in a soup. So it was a really, really big deal to be among mm-hmm. them in the same room and in my house. It was so special. And, you know, like I said, when you're returning to something you know, it's a lot easier than picking up a new skill.
Right.
And I did it. But it was really hard because, you know, the good girl in me and the hard worker and the person who really wanted to make the most of my time there would stay up late and write the sketches. But when mm-hmm. I got home at 8 o'clock in the morning from writing night, my baby had just gotten up, you know, it was crazy. I don't think my brain was focusing on anything else. You know, when I worked there, it was my first love, and I was so devoted to anything and everything Saturday Night Live. And because of the momentum of the week, because every new week is a new show produced, I was just hyper-focused on whatever mm-hmm. I needed to do that week. So I had to shift a bit to accommodate my new life, but I still knew that skill, but it was sort of like living with blinders on. Once mm-hmm. I stopped doing it, I realized how hard it was.
Right.
And why a lot of people just don't do it. It's really hard.
Yeah.
But some of us did it, and I don't know how. You don't hear of a ton of women just having newborns and working on that show. It's not that easy.
Did it contribute to your decision to leave in 2007? I mean,
Absolutely. Yeah.
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 So what was that like?
I mean, my contract was up, but mm-hmm. it was going to take, you know, wild horses to get me out of there. It was really hard to leave because I love it so much. And it was such a formative part of my career, but also truly the one huge thing I wanted. It was my biggest dream.
Right.
Was Saturday Night Live. So leaving was really difficult. Plus my friends were there, and it's such a play-based environment, getting to be with all these people that are funny and make you laugh. It's so hard to reproduce that.
You know, I feel like you were part of this really special cohort of women on SNL. It was you, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig was there while you were there. Why do you think that particular cohort of early 2000s SNL performers was so strong? I mean, did you guys know that you were part of this like really special cohort at the time?
At the time, I don't think we knew. I think it was pretty normal to us because we all came out of sketch comedy and we were all kind of doing the same thing, and some of us together. I mean, Amy and Tina and Rachel Dratch were all together at Second City. But at the time, people were telling us that we were working at a place that was a boys' club, and we were kind of looking around going, No, we're not. But it took a very long time for the story about who we were there to catch up with who we were.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
I just mean that people wanted to tell the story of us working in an environment that was considered a boys' club, and how did we deal with that? And we kept saying, mm-hmm. That's not what we're dealing with. But I think now that we look back on that time, people realize that the story is about this great group of people.
Right.
And a very large amount of us happen to be women. And I think the kind of women that all of us are, I mean, it's just an interesting convergence because so many of us are alike. You know, we're all mm-hmm. really good daughters, really good students. You know, we worked really hard there. We got our work done. Like, we were all these girls that just kind of had similar childhoods, like our own version of the same kind of wanting to be part of this special place and ended up there. around the same time. So it's very interesting.
So you are on the Time 100 this year, and Amy Poehler wrote your write-up for our issue.
Yeah.
You were just talking about this special moment where so many of these incredible women comedians were in the same place. How have some of those friendships evolved in the years since SNL? I mean, you've then gone on to work with lots of these women on other movies and other projects. How do you all keep in touch with each other?
Well, the relationships that we have continued to nurture through time is, it's impressive to me. But I think we've all realized that we all went through something very enormous together. And when you have a bond like that with people, they just know you in a different way. It's, I mean, we joke sometimes saying it's like we were all in the trenches together. We were all in the comedy army together. And it's really hard to explain that to another person. That language, that skill set that we all have, that trauma of live television, I'm sure the PTSD that has run through us over the years, we can all relate to each other. And it was also just, you know, we were together 24/7 a lot of the time. I mean, we were up all night writing together. Amy always talks about coming into mine and my friend Emily Spivey's office and just laying on the floor, because you need a place that feels safe to decompress or cry or do whatever. Rachel and I were talking recently about the musical guest dressing rooms. After they had their sound check, we would go in their room, and it was a social place to sit around and say, like, I'm having a day or a week or whatever. And we naturally gravitated towards that sort of support system, and it's carried on. So it's just been, I think, a byproduct of sharing something incredible with people. And not to say that men aren't welcome too, but the natural nurturing element of women and this desire to support each other and to be there for each other has just always kind of been a part of it. And I think as we've all matured and grown up a little bit, we all see the value in those friendships. And they're just, they're not like anything else.
Okay, what's next for you? I know you're in the middle of season two of Loot. What do you have next coming down the pipeline?
I have exciting stuff coming down the pipeline. I'm still doing my band. I feel like it's a little bit of a hike every time I have a princess show. I think, how the hell am I going to do this? And then we do it, and I think, oh, this is fun. Once I'm there, I have fun. Plus, I don't know. I just feel like there's a space that's carving itself out for me where I'm going to, I keep reminding myself, you're allowed to do more than one thing in this life and take a little time. And I, you know, since the show has come out, I've had a little bit of time for myself, and that's been really nice. I mean, listen, we're moms. Like, what do we, we're not going to, you know, it's not a a spa month. I'm just getting like an hour, but I'll take it.
So what do you do with that hour to yourself?
Nothing.
I know.
I mean, please. Truly, like,
if I watch Loot.
Yeah, I watch TV. I mean, listen, I usually watch TV when I'm sick. I'm not going to lie. Like, that's when I binge a show, sick or traveling. For me now, like, if I travel somewhere and I'm in a hotel room by myself, I feel like the Queen of England. I think it's the most luxurious thing in the world. And it is. And when I'm by myself, I can hear my thoughts. And that is a revelation. So I'm into those moments, those quiet moments. They are delightful.
Maya, it's been such a joy speaking with you about your Apple TV show Loot and SNL and your life since SNL. But now I want to ask you some questions about your everyday life in a segment we like to call The Last Time. So, when's the last time you did an impression of somebody?
I think this morning when I was explaining how annoying an email was.
Okay, when's the last time you saw a spider?
Yesterday. It was hanging above my front door.
And what did you do?
Just recoiled in horror and left it alone.
Yeah. When's the last time you spoke to your friend and former SNL colleague, Kristen Wiig?
We texted last week because I had just seen her fantastic SNL episode that she hosted, and I was raving about Aunt Linda.
I loved that episode too. When's the last time you sang in public?
You mean like a concert or like how I can't stop moving my mouth and singing every day of my life? Like in a performance?
Yeah. Like when's the last time you performed music in public?
It was our last Princess show. So it was right before Christmas.
Okay. Great. And then when's the last time you got all four of your kids to watch the same movie?
We actually watch a lot of movies at home, although I'll be mm-hmm. honest with you, one always manages to sneak away mm-hmm. and say like, this is scary or I have homework. There's always one kid that doesn't want to watch. But I would say it was just on spring break. Mm-hmm. And as a family, we all watched Anyone But You.
That was a good movie. I liked that a lot.
It was a good movie.
Yeah.
Feel the rain on your skin.
Maya, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you,
you
being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can find Maya Rudolph on our 2024 Time 100 list, out now. Thank you so much for listening to Person of the Week. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you. So send your tips or thoughts on our show to personoftheweek@time.com. I'm Charlotte Alter. See you next week.
Person of the Week is hosted by Charlotte Alter. It's produced by Nina Bisbano and Allison Bailey. Our senior producer is Ursula Summer. Our story editor is Katie Feather. This episode was mixed by Aaron Dalton. Our theme music was composed by Billy Libby. Joseph Frischmuth is our fact checker. Person of the Week is a co-production of Time Studios and Sugar 23. At Time, our executive producers are Dave O'Connor, Michael Erlinger, and Sam Jacobs. At Sugar 23, our executive producers are Mike Mayer, Michael Sugar, and Liam Billingham. Sasha Mathias is the head of audio at Time. You can find us online at time.com/personoftheweek and wherever you get your podcasts.